poor, baby, it'll be me. And I'll be looking for you. Gonna look on the mountains and in the deep blue sea. Gonna search all the forests, looking every tree. If you feel something heavy on your fishing hook, if you see a funny face in your comic book, baby, it'll be me. And I'll be looking for you. Hanging from a lamppost bright, baby, it'll be me. And I'll be looking for you. If you see somebody looking in all the car, if you see a rocket ship on its way to Mars, baby, it'll be me. And I'll be looking for you. Gonna look in the cities where the lights are blue. Gonna search the countryside, all the haystacks too. Well, if you see a new face on a totem pole, if you find a lump in your sugar bowl, baby, it'll be me. And I'll be looking for you.
Ken Tucker hosts Hearing Secret Harmonies every Wednesday at this time. If you'd like to write to him, our address is Fresh Air, WHYY-FM, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. And this is Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And with me now is Roger McGuinn, who from 1964 to 73 was the leader of the rock group The Byrds, which was one of the first American groups to be compared to the British bands like the Beatles. Their music was called folk rock because they drew on traditional ballads and included songs by Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan in their repertoire. The Byrds later became one of the first rock bands to use country music songs and instrumentation. Their hits included Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, 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 8 Miles High, My Back Pages, So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, Mr. Spaceman, The Ballad of Easy Rider, and You Ain't Going Nowhere. The Byrds went through many personnel changes. McGuinn was the only constant throughout their history. One of their original members, David Crosby, left the Byrds to form Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Then Chris Hillman and Graham Parsons left the band to form the Flying Burrito Brothers. McGuinn has recorded several solo albums since the band split up, and he's in Philadelphia to perform tonight at Philly's, which is located at 237 Chestnut Street. The sets begin at 9:30, and for more information, you can call Philly's at 925-0446. That's 925-0446. 0446. Well, Roger McGuinn has brought his guitar with him and is going to be singing some new songs as well as bird songs for us. And before we talk, Roger McGuinn, welcome to Fresh Air, and I'd love it if you could open with a song for us.
Thank you.
Crimson flames tied through my ear, growing high and mighty trap. Countless fire and flame and rope, using ideas as my map. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. Ride me, Peter Brown. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach. Fearing that I'd become my enemy in the instant that I preach. My existence led by confusion, both mutiny from stern to bow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half-racked prejudice leap forth, tear down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white, broke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers, foundation deep somehow. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
That's Roger McGuinn. You started off in folk music before becoming known as a rock musician, played with the Lime Ladders and the Chad Mitchell Trio. Did you get to this point where you had to choose which was it going to be, rock or folk?
No, actually, I never had a problem with rock. I started being interested in rock first, actually. I got interested in the guitar in 1956 when I heard Heartbreak Hotel. And I asked for a guitar for my birthday, and I got one that year. And I learned how to play rock first, actually. I started playing like the lead breaks off of rockabilly hits like Bebopalula and stuff like that. And my first year in high school, my music teacher, who was from Philadelphia, incidentally, invited Bob Gibson, a folk singer, and he did about a 45-minute show at the high school, and that converted me to folk music because I'd never seen a 5-string banjo before, and he played a whole set on it, and it knocked me out. And so I enrolled in the Old Town School of Folk Music after that and learned all about the traditional songs and how to pick them and the stories behind them, and I really got goosebumps from some of the folklore, and I really loved it. But my roots had before that been rock, so I had no problem with rock. Although the folk movement was very sort of down on rock, and while I was in it, I guess I was too, because I really didn't listen to much of it. But there wasn't much to rock to listen to at that point. It was kind of a greasy, you know, slick back rock at that point. It wasn't the rockabilly that had attracted me in the first place. It had gotten more, I don't know how to put it, but it was kind of a sleazier sound than I was attracted to in the first place. So when I came back into rock, it was the Beatles, which was a whole other thing. And I was working for Bobby Darin at the time. The Beatles came out, and I was working as a folk singer, backing him up in his show. He used to do his old standards, and then he'd break down in the middle of the show and do a folk segment for about 15 minutes. And I'd play 12-string guitar and sing harmony with him. And that was my job for about a couple of years, working with him.
So when you started listening to rock again, it was the Beatles that struck you. What was it about their music that made you want to re-enter rock?
Well, strangely enough, it was the folk music chords that they were playing inadvertently. They didn't really know it, but they were playing the kinds of changes that I'd been into when I was into folk music. And I really thought when I first heard them that they were coming from there, but when I met them and talked to them about it, they didn't really know about that. They were from the Elvis Presley school of music and all that. And so they just picked up the folk chords hanging around Liverpool. That was the way they learned to play. You know, I guess, Liverpool was a seaport town, and they used to get all kinds of records in there and different influences. But the local music was very folky, very Anglo, you know, folky. So they just picked up that kind of stuff naturally. And whereas I'd gone into it from being a city kid, you know, I'd gotten into the, you know, really studying up on it and the intellectual aspects of it, they just picked it up on the street. And I was into Ewan McCall and A.L. Lloyd and stuff like that, and they were just reflecting what they'd heard on the street.
Well, when you were with the Lime Ladders and the Chad Mitchell Trio, did you like their music?
Actually, I thought it was kind of slick. I was not really into it musically. It was more of a like a job opportunity. It was a good way to travel around, and it paid well and everything. I was a little bit on the defensive side about it because of real folk music people weren't too fond of that slick stuff. You know, it was kind of... So I was never really accepted in the folk movement. I was always on the outside of it, wanting to be into it, you know. And it was kind of frustrating.
Did you learn anything about performing that you used later after forming the Byrds from your playing with Chad Mitchell and the Lime Ladders and Bobby Darin?
Sure. You know, all that experience. I mean, I believe that if you're coming up in the music business, the best thing you can do is work all the time and get in front of audiences as much as you can. Get that experience, because it's one thing to be able to play flawlessly in your living room, but it's another thing to be able to do it under pressure. And you need that audience experience to really be able to do it.
So did you consciously leave that scene and say, forget it, I'm going to form a rock group?
Well, Bobby stopped working. He got into the publishing business. I guess it was a combination of health problems that forced him out of the performing end of it. And he started opening up his publishing company on a full-blown basis, and he hired me as a songwriter in the Brill Building, and I lived in New York, and I got $35 a week, and, you know.
Wow, that's really low.
That's what they pay. You know, it's because if you have a hit, then you get the royalties off of it and everything. It's like, anyway.
It's kind of like selling encyclopedias.
Yeah,
it was
not enough to make a living on, but it was, it was kind of fun. And what he had me doing was listening to the radio and getting into all the different people who were having hits at that point and then trying to emulate those sounds. And the Beatles came along right at that point. So I said, oh, you know, I know what this is, and from the old Bob Gibson and Gibson and Camp kind of changes. And I thought, you know, that's really neat. And I got into I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You. And I started playing them, and I started doing them down in the village at a coffee house that I was working at. And then I went out to L.A., and I was playing a solo gig at a place called the Troubadour, which it used to be a folk club. It's a new wave club now. And Gene Clark came in, and he saw me, and he said, I know what you're trying to do. I think we ought to work together. Let's write some songs. And so we did, and we had a little duo for about one day. And the next day, we were rehearsing in the coffee house part of it, which was a front room, which was also a McCabe's guitar store. It sold picks and strings and things. And one of the guys who worked there said, it sounds pretty good, but I think you could use another harmony. And just at that moment, David Crosby walked in the front door, and this guy, Paul, said, what about him? And I said, oh, I don't know, man. I've worked with him before. And I mean, I knew David from a couple of years ago, and I wasn't sure I could, you know, handle that. But anyway, we did work it out, and then we got a bass player and a drummer, and it became the Byrds.
Do you think there was a concept behind it? Did you have, like, a concept in mind?
Well, I was just into I was into rock and roll, this new kind, you know, the Liverpool sound and all that, and I had a folk music background plus a rockabilly background, and I think it just sort of evolved naturally. It wasn't like I said, let's put together a folk rock group, and here's what we'll do. You know, I didn't have a blueprint, really.
Let's listen to the first record of yours that became a hit.
All right.
And we'll hear Mr. Tambourine Man. Do you want to say anything about the recording of this? Why don't we wait till after we hear it?
Sure.
Okay. My guest is Roger McGuinn, and this is the group that he founded in 1964, The Byrds and Tambourine Man. That's The Byrds, and Roger McGuinn is my guest. Listening to that, I was thinking about how many millions of guitar players and would-be guitar players know every lick in that record that we just heard.
Well, that's nice.
how did that get to be your first hit? How did you choose that song?
Our first manager, Jim Dixon, was a friend of Dylan's, and Victor Maymuta's, who was Dylan's road manager at the time, sent a copy of that song with Jack Elliott with Dylan and Jack Elliott singing it in 2/4 time. It's like,
hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me.
Like that. And it had like 4 verses, and Elliott's harmony was a little out of tune. It was really folksy, you know. So Jim Dixon thought it could be a top 40 hit, and none of us could really see that at that point because we were listening for things like I Want to Hold Your Hand, and with the rock beat and everything. This was like a 2/4 folk song, and he said, well, change the beat. So, you know, we did that, and we eliminated all but one verse, and then we sort of auditioned within the group to see who was going to sing lead on it, and I got the part. And then that was it. Basically, we cut it in, I believe, January or February, and it sat in the can until June, and we all lost hope, you know, that it was even going to be released, much less be a hit. And, in fact, I almost went off into another band with a guy named Dino Valenti when we were going to wear spacesuits and wireless microphones and stuff. But it was released in June, and it became a hit within a couple of weeks, and it was amazing.
What did Dylan think of it?
He liked it. He'd seen us, I'd met him in the Village before that when I was working in New York, and he came out and saw us play at Ciro's and sat in with us, and he came to a couple of rehearsal sessions, and he was interested in the way we were putting rock beat to his songs. He was impressed by that. He said, hey, you can dance to it, and you could.
Do you think that affected how he started performing his own material?
Well, I'm sure it had some influence on him. I wouldn't say that it was the exclusive reason why he got into it, but I think it might have affected him to some extent.
Did your fans come up to you and give you the theories about what the Dylan songs that you sang really meant? Did people get into that?
They were more interested in the guitar changes and, you know, what kind of strings you were using and stuff like that.
When you were recording, when the band got together, did you have much control over how you were produced?
Not really at all, no. Terry Melcher was the first producer, and he got the job because he was Doris Day's son, and Doris Day was on the label. And then he'd also done some things in the Beach Boys-type vein with a group called the Ripcords. And that was Terry and Bruce Johnston.
What was their hit? I can't remember.
Little Deuce Coupe, or
yeah,
something,
right.
Something like that.
No, it wasn't Little Deuce Coupe.
I don't know.
It was, well,
I don't know. It's one of those. Yeah, that was the Beach Boys.
That was Beach Boys. Yeah.
It was something about a cobra or some kind of a car song.
Okay.
So anyway,
yeah.
So Terry had that kind of background, and in fact, if you listen closely to the instrumental track on Mr. Tambourine Man, you'll detect a Beach Boys type rhythmic pattern, which he was trying to. He was trying to emulate the pattern from Don't Worry, Baby. So it's the same beat, basically, as Don't Worry, Baby.
What do you think about the label folk rock that started to
be applied
to
your music? Well, I think it's appropriate, although we always resisted labels because they do tend to limit your creative flow. You really can't, you know, you have to stay in one or the other.
Just been informed that the Ripcord's hit was Hey Little Cobra.
Hey Little Cobra, okay. So.
You also recorded a Pete Seeger song adapted from Ecclesiastes, Turn, Turn, Turn. How did you choose that for the repertoire?
Well, I'd worked with Judy Collins arranging her third album for her, and she did it on that album, so I'd known the song, and I'd also heard Pete do it, and I was a big fan of Seeger's and all that. And I was on the road with the Birds, and somebody asked me if I knew the song, and I started playing it.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow. A time to cast away stone, a time to gather stone together. Everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time of love, a time of hate, a time of war, a time of peace. A time you may embrace, a time for peace. I swear it's not too late.
Were you surprised at what a big hit the record became?
Well, you're always surprised when you release a record to see what it does. You never know what it's going to do. And I was surprised that the first one went to number one. I think after that, because of the amount of momentum we generated, it wasn't too surprising that anything, you know, that we did right away after that would also have a pretty high spot. But to see it go number one was pretty much of a surprise, too, yeah.
There were comparisons that were made between the Byrds and the Beatles. What did you think of those comparisons?
Well, we were, you know, consciously emulating certain aspects of the Beatles, so I can understand anybody comparing us in that respect.
Which ones were you emulating?
Well, at the first, you know, we were emulating everything, the guitars we were playing, the kinds of drums and the haircuts and the boots and the everything, the whole deal. And then we gradually evolved into our own sound and look.
Did you think about your look much since... I don't know, no matter how unconscious performers look, I always figure there has to be some consciousness behind that since
there's
you
a little,
are.
You know, you think about an interesting story. When we first started, we had the little suits like the Beatles had with the little velvet collars and everything. But we were playing at a club and some other band that was playing there ripped off our suits. And we told the Beatles about this later and they said that they'd wish somebody would rip their suits off too. You know?
So did your style just evolve, your visual style, or was that a conscious thing after the suits got stolen?
Well, then all we had left were blue jeans, so, you know, we were wearing T-shirts and jeans, and that was the look.
You started playing just before, like, progressive underground radio, and I think there was still, when you started, a pretty tight airplay list on most of the rock stations.
Right.
How did that change in rock stations and rock radio play affect your career?
I think it was beneficial to us because the kind of stuff we were doing was really a little different from the standard rock stuff. We were always experimenting and trying different sounds, and I think things like, 8 Miles High and that kind of stuff was definitely out there compared to what had been popular before that. So I think it was to our advantage that radio was getting more freedom at that point. It's since lost it, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, we'll get Except back to that
this.
Subject a little later.
Yeah.
You mentioned 8 Miles High. Now, that was a song that was assumed to be about being high on drugs. And
right.
There were
that was unfortunately not what it was about, but this one character thought it was, and he spread the rumor around, and it got kind of knocked down in airplay lists and so on.
What was the song about?
Well, we wrote it about our first trip to England, which was kind of a disaster. The background on it, we'd just done a 30-day bus tour in the United States, and we got the offer to go to England and play some dates over there. So we were so excited about it that we just jumped on a plane and flew over there, being exhausted and not really being a professional band for very long. I mean, maybe only about 8 or 10 months. We weren't that steady on stage, and we went over there and were kind of, a little shaky. And we got bad reviews, and we all came down with the flu, and, you know, it was really a disaster. So when we came home, we wrote 8 Miles High about our trip to England, 8 Miles High, Well, it started out being 6 miles high, which is about 36,000 feet, which was the airplane altitude. And I think Gene Clark said, no, 8 miles high sounds better, which it did. And then we, you know, just proceeded to tell the story of what the cultural shock that we encountered was like. When you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known, a rain gray town known for its sound and all that stuff. So it's basically about our trip to England.
Let's hear a couple of minutes of it, and then we'll talk some more about it.
Okay.
Birds and 8 miles High, and my guest is Roger McGuinn. So a lot of people assumed that that song was about drugs, and there were movements in some cities, weren't there, to keep it off the radio?
Yeah, well, there's a thing called the Gavin Report, which is a playlist or a recommendation to radio stations as to what songs to play and not to play. And people subscribed to it, and it said that it was a drug song and not to use it, and so people didn't.
A lot of people did, though.
Yeah. It got a lot of play. It got to, I think, number 12 on the charts, which is, you know, okay.
Did it strike you as being very absurd that this song that you apparently didn't even intend to be about drugs was?
Well, it was kind of it was kind of a false accusation and a bit of a witch hunt.
How do you feel about things like that, since that's still the kind of issue that's discussed in some towns and cities now, whether it's songs about sex or drugs, should be on the radio. Does that strike you as absurd?
Well, I'm for freedom of speech, so.
Members of the Byrds have had changed a lot through the years as they went on. Do you see it as the group as having different periods, different set periods?
That's the way it turned out. It wasn't, anybody's fault or anybody's conscious decision to keep it in different structures. Like, we didn't say, okay, let's go country now and you guys leave and we'll do this or whatever. Basically, it fell apart because of poor organization, I'd say. That's all. That wasn't, we weren't a team. We didn't hang together. Like, say, the Rolling Stones.
Right. did it bother you when David Crosby left to do Crosby, Stills, and Nash?
Well, he didn't really leave to do Crosby, Stills, and Nash. We actually fired him.
Oh.
So, and he was not doing anything for about a year, and then he got into that. And we were all really amazed and glad for him.
What did you fire him for?
Well, we just weren't getting along. You know, Chris and I couldn't get along with David, and so Chris and I ganged up on David and said, "You're out." And he was, "Oh man, come on." You know, we could make good music together, and we said, "Well, we can make good music without you." And so, you know, we were just being punks, and that's what I mean. It was just we weren't a team. We weren't working together.
Is there a lot of jealousy amongst different rock groups about who's making it and who's not?
Not necessarily between the groups, but I think there's more infighting in groups than there is. Fighting between groups.
You read about who's the front person and the lead singer and the guitarist.
It's just a lot of internal power struggle and so on.
Did the record company do a lot of publicity for you then, or was it mostly just... Because I think the whole record industry was pretty different in the 60s and early 70s than it is now.
You know, I don't really know what they did. I wasn't that involved with the commercial end of it. You know, we'd just go in and cut stuff, and then we'd be on vacation for a while, or we'd go on the road, and it was kind of a carefree existence. We really didn't pay much attention to the business of it.
Did you control where you were touring and who you played for?
No, I had no control over it whatsoever. It was completely run by agents and managers and accountants, and we were puppets, really. I mean, we were working for them, which is so different from what I'm doing now. I'm really on my own, which is really neat. I pay the bills, and I, you know, take charge of it. My wife and I tour together, and she's a road manager. That's like a tight little unit. It's kind of neat.
So it's doing it all in your own your own control.
Yeah.
One of your songs, "Rock and Roll Star," expresses a lot of cynicism about being a rock performer. Does that basically sum up how you felt about it?
Well, we were trying to have a sense of humor about it, but it's a bit cynical. And the way that came about was Chris Hillman and I were sitting in his house one day, thumbing through one of these teen magazines, and noticing the how fast the turnover was in personalities, you know, like so-and-so would be popular for 6 months and then out and you'd never hear about him again and so on. And so we were basically writing it about that.
Okay, let's listen to Rock and Roll Star.
Listen. what you are. You're a rock and roll star. La 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 la.
Rock and Roll Star, that's performed by the Byrds, and my guest is Roger McGuinn. Do you like being a star? Is it?
Did I?
Yeah, do you? Or?
That was fun. Those are real screams, by the way,
from
one of our concerts in England. And I had a little cassette recorder with me, and I had it on stage, and we taped it.
Is being a superstar fun? Or
I don't know. I don't think I've ever been a superstar. Uh-huh. That's something that came along after I, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Got out of the Byrds and all that. But I imagine it would be, you know, I don't know. Have to find out sometime.
While the band was playing, the whole kind of psychedelic kind of culture came into being. Did you find your music changing with that and your audiences changing and their expectations of you?
You mean getting more psychedelic and all that than we were?
Yeah.
I suppose so, yeah, although I really wasn't aware of it. I think that we were just trying to stay one step ahead of the game, and we were actually a little out there, you know, as far as what the public wanted. We're always too far out, you know, like going to country music, for instance, in 1968, when we had short hair and cowboy boots and all that stuff. Nobody knew where we were coming from. I mean, they said, what's this? You know, these guys have gone redneck on us. They've betrayed us. They've left us. So the kids didn't like it, and the rednecks didn't like it, and nobody liked it. You know, it's like we were out in the cold, popularity-wise. And then a few years later, the stuff that we had done back then became popular as sort of as people caught up with what we were into. So,
how did the country music enter into your...
We ran into Graham Parsons, and I hired him as a jazz piano player, and he played piano for a little while, and then he started developing into like a Hank Williams, you know, and I didn't know that all along he had been this other person, you know. So we started doing more and more country music in our show, and it eventually got to the point where he and Chris wanted to get a steel guitar player and become a complete country band, but my interests were more into rock and jazz rock, and you know, I wanted to get off into that. So that's when the split happened, and they went off and formed the Flying Burrito Brothers, and I kept the Byrds and got Clarence White and those guys, and we went out and did that for a while.
You changed your name from Jim McGuinn to Roger.
Mm-hmm.
McGuinn.
My name is actually James Roger.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But it used to be James Joseph McGuinn III. And I changed my middle name because I was into this Eastern thing, which I'm not into anymore. But I sent away to Indonesia for the name change, and it was supposed to be, you know, harmonize with your vibrations or something like that.
You sound cynical about that now.
Well, I'm not. I don't believe it now, that particular thing.
Are you religious now?
Yeah, I'm a born-again Christian now.
When did that happen?
That happened about 1977.
Was there an experience in your life that sparked that?
I kind of bottomed out as far as... you know, I was breaking up a marriage, and I'd been doing a lot of drugs and alcohol, and I was kind of just wasted and having a lot of anxiety, and I finally just asked Jesus into my life, and it made me feel a lot better.
I've noticed there's a lot of TV shows, like on the religious programming, where a lot of born-again performers perform. Have you ever been invited on those shows?
No, I haven't. I haven't really gotten into that whole arena. That's a whole other world that...
Is it a world you want to keep out of?
Well, I'm not consciously keeping out of it. I'm just not consciously getting into it. I haven't felt spiritually led to get into that area. I think it's something that you have to sort of be called into, and I haven't been called into it. I think that as far as I'm concerned, I'm to stay where I was when I got into Jesus. And where I was playing clubs and doing rock and roll and, you know, what I do. So I'm still doing that. And I feel very good about it.
Is it a letdown for you to play small clubs after playing, you know, really big halls and having your records on the charts?
Last week I just played a couple of 2,000-seaters with Renaissance and stuff, so I still, you know, get a taste of that. And the clubs are fun. I enjoy the intimate atmosphere.
Was it, did you, like, take stock of your life and all of this when the Byrds broke up?
The Byrds broke up in 73 when I disbanded it because we were going to do a reunion album with the original Byrds, which didn't turn out too well. But I was thinking at that point I didn't want there to be two sets of Byrds. So I disbanded the Clarence White Byrds. And I was ready for the original Byrds to maybe tour again or whatever. But the album didn't do well enough to merit that. So we just sort of fell apart there, too. And I pursued a solo career and did a few solo albums on Columbia. And that was kind of a disappointment that my solo career didn't take off at that point. But I believe you have to stick with it and hang in there. So that's what I'm doing.
I'd like it if you could play one of your new songs for us.
Sure.
And my guest is Roger McGuinn, if you're just joining us.
Okay, this is a song that my wife got in a dream about 3 o'clock in the morning. And she told me about it the next day, and I got my guitar out and helped her write it.
Woman, you gotta love yourself. Woman, you gotta know yourself before you can share your heart with me. Woman, you gotta show me life. Woman, you gotta cut the strife before I can share my life with you. And if you want me to, I'll help you all I can. I could be your man in time. Working together, life just wouldn't be as hard if you join your loving heart with mine. Woman, I got a love for you. Woman, what are you gonna do? Don't leave me here to wander all alone. Woman, it could be so good. Woman, if you only would say you'd be the love I'm looking for. All along I've known it's true. I could be in love with someone just like you. Woman, you gotta love yourself. Woman, you gotta know yourself before you can share your heart with me. And if you want me to, I'll help you all I can. I could be your man in time. Working together, life just wouldn't be as hard if you join your loving heart with mine, with mine, with mine.
Thanks for performing that.
Thank you.
So it came in a dream, huh?
Yeah, she got it in a dream. Yeah, really, I'm not sure of the whole story, but she just got the words and the tune for the first couple of lines. And she came to me the next day and she said, I think I got a song, you know. And she started, woman, you gotta love yourself. Woman, you gotta know yourself. And so I got my guitar out and started picking it out and got the chords with it and put some of the rest of the words to it and so on.
The songs ever come to you in dreams?
Yeah, I've had a couple of songs come to me in dreams. There was one called Tiffany Queen about 7-8 years ago that I got I got the whole thing in a dream. The words and the music, all the words and all the music and the whole thing. I just heard the whole thing in a dream, and I got up real fast and wrote it down and went in the studio that week and recorded it. And it's on a really obscure Byrds album, the very last Byrds album with Clarence White called Farther Along. It's on that record.
One of my ambitions is to actually have a coherent thought in a dream that I could really use. They always seem coherent until you wake up. And
right. Yeah, well, that's what happens most of the time to me, but this time I had a complete song.
Well, as we were discussing before, radio airplay has really changed since you started playing music. What's your perceptions of that now?
Well,
rock radio stations.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think they're playing a certain kind of music that I really can't get into at this point. And I'd like it to come back to more like a folky kind of thing. I'd like to see that happen. Right now it's like a techno-rock sort of very narrow programming. It's very narrow.
Well, you had you were probably one of the first people to start working with synthesizers,
right?
In the Byrds, do you not enjoy the way they're being used now?
Well, you know, I like some of the music. It's just that that's not where I'm coming from right now. I think I might be out ahead a little bit again. Where I'm back into my longing is to get back into acoustic music,
uh-huh.
And you know, I hear like acoustic stuff now in my head, and it sounds better to me. I'm kind of burned out on rock actually from all the years and years of. Of rock, you know, it's like it's not that attractive a thing to me anymore.
Do you listen to any of the punk music or new wave?
I listen to some of it. Yeah, I like some of it. Yeah.
So, do you listen to a lot of music at home, or?
Yeah, I listen to different things. You know, I listen to a lot of classical and jazz and just all kinds across the board, different types of stuff. Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. Can you do another one of your new songs for us?
Sure. This is a song about what it's like to be on the road and really have a good time at it, and you know all the different places you see and. And the sweet memories that are a result of that.
California summers, New England falls, Colorado winters, the wild wind calls, the wild wind calls. Springtime dogwoods blossom in every southern town. And now's the time to get around. Sweet memories we will have. Sweet memories, yes, we'll have. Sweet memories, you and me. You and me, you and me. From the Rock at Morro Bay to Cape Cod Sounds, Davis Island Lighthouse, Circus Clown, Sarasota Clowns. And Mrs. Wilkes for dinner in old Savannah Town. And now's the time to get around. Sweet memories we will have. Sweet memories, yes, we'll have. Sweet memories, you and me, you and me, you and me, you and me.
Thanks for performing that. I always wondered what our generation's nostalgia would be like after seeing, like, my parents' generation really be obsessed with Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman. And there, as it turns out, there are radio stations that are completely devoted now to playing music of the 60s or of the late 50s and 60s or the 60s mm-hmm. and early 70s. What do you think of nostalgia now, nostalgia for the recent past?
I think it serves a purpose. It does tend to rake out those memories that you've tucked away and... And when you hear a certain song, it brings them all back in living color. You know, it's great. It does it for me. And I can, you know, sometimes when I play some of the old songs, you know, people just go, ah, and, you know, put their hand on their forehead and just their heads back. And, you know, it's like an overwhelming experience. And that's kind of nice.
What's your nostalgia? What does that for you?
I think it would be like the Weavers and Pete Seeger and stuff like that. And, well, maybe some of the rockabilly things like Gene Vincent and Carl Perkins, some of the early Johnny Cash.
Do you have favorite recordings from your albums?
I'd have to look at a discography to tell you what my favorites were. I like a lot of it, and it's fun to listen to some of it back. You know,
do you own all your records?
No, there are a couple I don't have copies of. I don't have a copy of Farther Along, for instance. And I think they're hard to get now. So.
I've seen a lot of musicians wince when they listen back to their own music.
Yeah, well, some of it is embarrassing. You hear things that are out of tune or things that you really didn't know the words to or stuff like that.
But you basically have a rapport with your early recordings.
I like some. I mean, for instance, Tambourine Man plays well. I think it sounds pretty good. So.
Are you in touch with Dylan anymore? I know you were on the Rolling Thunder review with
him. I haven't seen him for a few years, actually. The last time I saw him was in San Francisco at the Warfield Theater where he was playing, and I got up on stage with him and did a couple of songs.
Is it confusing when you kind of keep track with your friends by reading newspapers and magazine articles, which I'm sure happens to you and the people you know a lot?
I don't think it's any more confusing than seeing him on the street.
Right. So you're living in a small town now on the West Coast.
Right.
Why have you chosen that kind of fishing village rural
atmosphere? It's a nice
rural
getaway.
Atmosphere?
Yeah. I got tired of all the hustle and bustle of L.A. and the smog and all that stuff. And there was no real reason why I needed to be there. I didn't need to be there for my career or anything like that, so I got out.
Do you have any new albums coming out in the near future?
I'm looking for a deal right now. So
okay.
As soon as I get one, I'll do that.
Well, I hope to hear something in the near future, and I want to thank you very much for being here and for performing
for
us.
For
I really
me.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks.
It was fun.
Roger McGuinn has been my guest, and he was the founder of the Byrds and is now recording solo records and will be performing solo tonight at Philly's, which is a club at 237 Chestnut Street in Philadelphia. The performance will start at 9:30. There is an opening band, and for more information, you can call 925-0446. That's 925-0446. I think before we check in with Shadow Traffic, we have time to play another record. How about we listen to You Ain't Going Nowhere? And we don't have it up. we do. Okay. Okay, let's listen to Jesus Is Just All Right With Me. The Byrds, and Roger McGuinn, who was the founder of the Byrds, will be at Philly's tonight at 237 Chestnut Street. Well, in just a moment, I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, but first, let's check in with Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. So far, no major problems on the Schuylkill Expressway. You'll find the normal slow volume eastbound between 30th and South. Minor delays westbound at Vine, Girard, and 202. A 20 to 25-minute delay northbound on the Roosevelt Extension as you travel through the detour. Northbound 95 looks pretty good right now, just a little bit slow at the Ray Street merger. Southbound 95 slow from midspan on the Girard Point Bridge down to the Platte Detour Road at Island. Average speed there about 515 miles per hour. Northbound Wissahickon Drive slow from approaching Henry through Rittenhouse, and a couple of accidents in the Cedarbrook section of Philadelphia, one at 79th Avenue and Limekiln Pike, and one at Mount Pleasant Avenue near the near Pickering, so caution should be used in those areas. And that's shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
That shadow traffic report was funded with a grant by Wilkie Buick Subaru. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Christine Pylon and Dr. Simon Schoon, founders of a Christian community living on a kibbutz in Israel. At 3:45, George Mazai will be my guest. He's the former editor of Gentleman's Quarterly and author of a new book called The New Office Etiquette, Getting Along in the Corporate Age. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Karen DeCrow, who's a former president of the National Organization for Women and the author of a new book called Women Who Marry Houses. It's a feminist analysis of agoraphobia, and that's the name for the fear of leaving the house and being outside. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can be with us. Ken Tucker contributed to this afternoon's program. Fred Snyder was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller is the co-producer of the show. My name is Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM, listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
Does this woman have the character of someone who could pick up a tire iron and beat someone over the head of it? And that will be the issue of the trial, the credibility of the witnesses.
It will be a trial for murder in Louisiana. Accused is Jenny Foate, a leading feminist in California. The murder happened many years ago. Ms. Foate says she is not guilty. That story tonight on All Things Considered.
Also tonight, President Reagan puts his case for Central America before a joint session of Congress and the audience at home.
More hearings in Congress concerning Agent Orange.
National Secretaries Week. We'll talk with one happy professional.
And with a woman getting ready to climb Mount Everest.
Also, Wendell Berry reads from his novel, A Place on Earth.
That and more on All Things Considered. First, this news.
This is John Hockenberry. President Reagan will present a detailed review of Central American policy before a joint session of Congress this evening. The speech will be nationally broadcast on this network beginning at 8 Eastern Time. The president gave his own preview of the address at a meeting with newspaper publishers in New York today.
We must respond with both unity and firmness of purpose. The peoples of the hemisphere, this hemisphere, are all Americans, and all of us share a vital stake in the future of democracy and freedom. We have it within our power to act now to keep the situation manageable, and it's in this spirit that I shall speak to the Congress and to the nation tonight.
Mr. Reagan called the unrest in Central America a fire in our front yard. Tonight he is expected to formally announce that a U.S. envoy for Central America will be named to help with Salvadoran elections later this year and to supervise U.S. policy in the region. Much of the president's purpose in going to New York today, though, was to talk up his notion of what needs to be reported in news. Mr. Reagan thinks good news is ignored, news which he says lifts the spirits and provides insights into our society. As an example, he visited a successful police precinct in Manhattan with the best arrest record in New York. The president said the precinct shows what is right and good about America. There was some good economic news today. American workers produced more during the first quarter and did it more efficiently, according to the Labor Department. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports an increase in all levels measured: overall output, output per hour worked, and hours worked. In manufacturing, productivity was up more than 7% annually after 6 months of declines. General business sector productivity was up at a more than 2% annual rate. Ed Freeman from Chase Econometrics says this improvement in productivity is good news, but not particularly surprising.
The fact is, output improves before people get hired back to work. You put your existing workforce on overtime before you decide to return some workers to the workforce. As a consequence, this is a purely cyclical phenomenon. It has nothing to do with people being better at their job or having superior tools or having superior education or any of the more fundamental aspects associated with long-term productivity growth.
Freeman says that the productivity figures show an economy poised to begin hiring significant numbers of workers. The State Department said today Costa Rican authorities have seized explosives from a ship headed for Nicaragua. Crew members on the Panamanian-registered freighter told authorities they were carrying Swiss-made agricultural chemicals, but a search turned up more than 100 tons of explosives. The Reagan administration says Nicaragua is supplying arms to leftist forces in El Salvador. The Interior Department today denied before Congress a charge it has auctioned off coal leases at extremely low prices. An assistant Interior Secretary said low-cost leases in Montana represented only about 1% of the Federal Reserves in that state, and part of the discount had to do with technical problems in mining the coal. A congressional report has charged that companies mining on federal land have made windfall profits due to favorable federal terms. Secretary of State George Shultz carried the Reagan administration's peace initiative to Jerusalem today. He spent 3 hours meeting with Prime Minister Begin and Israeli Foreign Minister Yitzhak Shamir, discussing troop withdrawal negotiations with Lebanon. The BBC's David McNeil describes today's meeting as a listening session more than anything else.
The American Secretary of State is clearly in no great hurry to force the issue. According to Israeli officials, he spent the entire 3 hours of the talks listening to a detailed explanation from the Israelis of where the talks with Lebanon stand. The Israelis went over those issues where there was no agreement with the Lebanese and those where there was agreement in principle, but where details remained to be worked out. They talked about the future role of the South Lebanese militia leader, Major Haddad, and his men, the Israeli demand for joint patrols with Lebanese troops, the future of UN forces, and the subject of a new relationship to be formed between Israel and Lebanon. The question of Syrian forces in Lebanon was not raised at today's initial meeting. Afterwards, Israeli officials emphasized that on the question of withdrawal, any agreement must ensure that the remaining PLO forces leave Lebanon first, to be followed by a simultaneous withdrawal of Israeli and Syrian forces. And they added that if Syria did not withdraw, Israel would not leave either.
The BBC's David McNeil in Jerusalem. The next stop on Mr. Shultz's agenda, Beirut, where he will listen to the Lebanese side of the stalled negotiations. Meanwhile, in that country's troubled Bekaa Valley, Syrian troops fired on Israeli bulldozers for the second day in a row. There were no reports of any injuries, and Israeli forces did not return the fire. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped off by just over 1 point. The index now stands at 1208.4. The average price of a share lost 6 cents on the New York Exchange. A baseball record was set in Montreal today. Veteran pitcher Nolan Ryan pitched a five-hitter against the Expos. That's no record, of course, but in the bottom of the eighth inning, Ryan broke the all-time Major League strikeout record. Ryan has fanned 3,509 hitters in his career. The previous record was set back in 1927. I'm John Hockenberry, National Public Radio in Washington.
President Reagan goes before a joint session of Congress this evening to bolster support for administration policies in Central America. Yesterday, in an interview with the newspaper USA Today, and again this afternoon in a speech before the nation's newspaper publishers in New York, the president previewed what he is likely to say in his nationally broadcast address. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports.
There are supposed to be some surprises tonight, some declassified documents which the president will use to help make his case. Those surprises aside, the basic case the president will be attempting to make, the theme of his address, will sound familiar. Namely, that the United States has vital interests at stake in Central America, and that those interests are threatened by foreign-supported revolutionary forces. The president put it this way this afternoon, speaking to the American Newspaper Publishers Association.
We're not accustomed to thinking very much about that region. Not accustomed to worrying about possibly a military threat in our own hemisphere. We've almost taken for granted the friendly, independent neighbors that we have.